The plot to Perry Mason's second season thickens, and we'll sort through the evidence. The Mandalorian may have a problem, and Bob Odenkirk is back on AMC as the titular Lucky Hank. All that on this week's episode of the podcast.
An elevator tape projection.
Hey, welcome to Taking It Down, the TV and movie podcast produced by the Alabama Take. I'm Blaine Duncan, editor-in-chief of the Alabama Take and one of the hosts for the show. Taking It Down's here because I thoroughly enjoy dissecting why I like what I like and why I dislike what I dislike when it comes to TV, movies, even books and music. I have an English degree and a side hustle as an English teacher, so I'll try my best to offer insight that you can use in conversation with others or with us. Luckily, my ideas aren't the only set of viewpoints on the podcast each week, because with me every week are these three. Adam Morrow, who's an erudite traveling and studio musician with a penchant for fine literature. Donovan Reinwald, a media specialist with encyclopedic knowledge on film and more. Plus, Natalie Morrow, the first person to ask about fantasy, sci-fi, comics, trashy reality TV, and Beyoncé's music. From us, you'll get the obvious and the obscure. We're here for the TV and film obsessed who are too busy for anything more than the show or movie itself. We'll give the outside of Hollywood analysis with zero Southern stereotype. Well, other than me today, there's only one more host. Here he is. He's not only the assistant coach of UConn Huskies basketball, but he's also the chair of the East Connecticut State Media Department. Donovan Reinwald.
Great to be here, Blaine.
Did I get one of those colleges at least right?
Yeah. You got UConn right, and there is an Eastern Connecticut State University. So you got your two for two.
No, I meant where you literally work. Actually,
oh, no, I work at Middlesex Community College.
Oh, why did I think East Connecticut State College? Because
where'd you get that from?
Isn't it in?
It's in Willimantic, or Windham.
Windham. I was going to say, yeah. Windham. I was trying to think, but my mind kept thinking Twin Peaks. Why am I thinking? It's funny what your brain will connect it. Anyway, that's us. It's just us two.
Just as chickens.
Just as two chickens. No real roosters on the farm today. No Adam and no Natalie.
Oh, we've been demoted.
We're going to talk about some Perry Mason and his motorcycle. In actuality, the plot, it started laying out a few more strings to tie together.
I'm still too mad about you spoiling whether or not he gets on his motorbike every episode to really have a civil discussion about this.
Well, I didn't spoil the big thing about it, though, which was he let his kid ride.
Yeah,
he right. Took his kid to school on it and caught flack, at least from side eyes.
This is not related to the plot, but it is... His kid is so inconsequential to me in this show. Went to Teddy's school in the first episode, I think. I was like, oh, since when does he have a kid? Yeah. Are you introducing something new?
Yeah.
No, exactly. I just didn't care about it.
He's only in about two or three episodes in the first season.
Yeah, he's barely there.
Let's catch everybody up. We're at the third episode of the second season of Perry Mason. I think we're all in on this. It's been good so far. We'll be spoiling it up through the third one, so beware of that. Perry's back in the saddle, but I suppose back on the motorcycle of criminal defense.
He's really back on the motorbike.
Yeah, in more than one way. And he's attempted to help out two brothers who are accused of murdering a one percenter.
Yeah, prominent. Prominent figure.
Prominent figure. One percenter's son, at least, I suppose you could say. Yeah, we could start with the motorcycle, but yes. The son even feels inconsequential here because it's more of a device to get him to go talk to the teacher again.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was kind of fun. Like, it was kind of funny when he's like, you want to go to a movie? And then they go see King Kong. Like, that made me chuckle.
That was nice. And then the horror of the school marm saying, you saw King Kong. Oh.
Yeah. But you're right. It was just to reintroduce the teacher.
I don't know. I felt chemistry. I thought it was okay. I really was like, oh, yeah, he's going to probably end up dating her and it's going to be awkward. And I'm kind of I'm okay with that slight little C or D or E plot. You know, give Perry something to do besides look wistfully at his broken pictures.
He needs something else in his life.
he needs happiness. Apparently the drive out to the old farm is way too long to hook up with the current owner. She probably Mexican descent.
I think she's supposed to be Mexican.
Yeah, and she also, do you remember in the first season, she also helped him by piloting a plane?
Yes.
She's an excellent pilot, And
one of my favorite moments in the first season is when they're in bed together and he falls out of the bed.
Yeah, you mentioned that earlier.
Love it.
It's pretty funny. So this show is kind of straight-laced, straightforward. It's noir in a way. There's not a lot of room for comedy, but I did find that kind of funny where she was like, oh, I didn't know that a child should go to King Kong. And then, of course, us nearly 100 years later are like, oh, come on. Just wait. Like, taking him to King Kong is the equivalent to taking a kid to The Exorcist in the 70s or to Saw in the late 90s. Let's get it. Let's start unpacking this. The reason why I want to talk about it this week in particular is because of the plot. I wanted to make sure I had it all straight.
I don't think I have it all straight.
I tried my best. In fact, I think that's what makes us who we are, is we come from an outsider's point of view. Let me just say, I'll start with saying that I'm a big proponent of shows that use, and movies, that use another time period to reflect on our own, mm-hmm. whether it's serendipitous or purposeful. Perry Mason had those moments once again this week, and they deepened those from last week when he talks about the Mexican-American guys in jail, and he's talking to the judge, and he says they don't have control of their own future because of their station in life. He mentions that sort of to the judge, but he also brings it up again. And the lawyer, the McCutcheon gentleman who's been killed by someone, was trying to play the feel sorry for the super rich people card, which is one we hear. You turn on Fox News or anything to the right of that, and you hear these poor people who have $1 billion.
They barely get by.
They can barely get by. Now, granted, on this show, the McCutcheons do have a murdered son. And that, yes, death is horrible. It's hard to deal with, especially if it's a father who's grieving for a son or a father grieving for a child, mother grieving for a child. That's not the way it kind of should work usually. Okay, they get my sympathy there, but not with the way the lawyer and the father is, you know, they got that hint of evil around them. And, you know, it's again, I said it earlier, it's noir. They are our antagonist for the season. And did you pick up on they're playing this in a way that's a bit of a statement? They're writing this in a way that's a bit of a statement about our current climate?
The immigration or lack thereof aspect of it, really, you know, because it's a little bit about, like, who belongs and who gets justice, who is afforded justice, who is important enough for justice, who, yeah, I think they're not... I mean, maybe they are laying it on a little thick sometimes, but I really don't think it's that heavy-handed. I was just going to say it's more like Perry's comments and the lawyer's comments, and it kind of develops from there.
In fact, the only thing I found heavy-handed this season are two things, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
The teacher relation, you can see the spark in their eye. You know exactly where this is going. But the other big thing was the villainous turn of the McCutcheon patriarch.
Oh, yeah. When he
assaults the worker, that felt really ham-fisted to me. And it's one of the few times that this show has been, you know, a little too ham-fisted.
It's like, we get it. He's evil. Mm-hmm. Like, he's a bad guy.
The other side of the coin is that his talk with Mason was a better reveal. Mm-hmm. His talk with Perry at the horse race. I'm losing my terminology. But anyway,
Racetrack,
that's it. You bet. The dialogue was working much better there. He was more threatening there. He signals he can do things, and he mentions the long-gone Mason farm, and he's like, oh, well, he can mind out some things, right? He's not. He has his own detectives, of course.
They didn't do anything groundbreaking with that, but I thought that it was menacing. More, like you said, more overtly or more menacing than when he overtly, you know, smashes or not smashes, cuts that guy's face up with the.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is like Matthew Reese's performance is a mix of like bravado and, but he's also scared. Like, like when he's walking down the hall, he's kind of looking around nervously before he goes out into the racetrack. And I think that that really kind of helps add to the menace there.
You know, you make a good point there. Your acting partner, it's a lot like wrestling. I don't know how deep you ever got into wrestling, but honestly, it comes down to, in wrestling and acting apparently, that your partner can make and break you. In wrestling, if they don't sell it, if it's them that's taking the bump, and if they don't look like they're legitimately hurt, then you're not believing this particular wrestler has any power over the other guy or girl in the ring. And so when Perry is talking to him, he does have an expression of, you know, it drifts into, you're not going to scare me, to, oh, I didn't know you knew that. That is kind of frightening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that having the son in this episode is supposed to work in a manner to get Perry near the teacher, but also to remind you that the son could be in danger because this guy has knowledge of LA stuff.
I wondered, and they're probably not doing this, but I wondered if they were going to or are going to parallel Perry's fatherhood with Mr. I can't remember his first name, Mr. McCutcheon.
I can't remember his first name either.
I can only remember his son's name, Brooks.
Yeah.
Mean old Mr. McCutcheon. But I wonder if that's going to be ever contrasted with like the way he's reacting versus the way Perry will react or is reacting to something involving his kid. I don't know. Probably not. But I thought it might be interesting.
Wasn't there a allusion or two in the first season that Perry had trouble with his own father?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
I would be interested to see. It's an opportunity that they could do.
Yeah, like you said earlier, it's probably like down there in the E-plot.
Yeah, it could be.
You know, it may not be that important, but it would give Perry something to do other than, yeah, stare sadly at death certificates.
Dodson's old newspaper clippings.
Yeah. Yep.
One of the classic moves of the more high-level dramas or complicated dramas is they don't mind being a little complex with their conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Just they don't hold your hand through some of them. I think broadcast television tend to shy away from that kind of thing because they want you to tune in every single week. It's so much more based on advertising dollars. This episode did the thing where they throw in a lot of information in short conversations, and it's kind of one of those things where you go, I didn't get that, but they're going to probably explain it. I just need to put a pin in that for just a little bit.
That's the way I felt about a lot of the plot point, even things like, it's not really information, but like at the end where he finds like the bullets match up. It's like, okay, this is important, but they don't bother telling you why it's important. They're just, you just kind of have to trust that like they're gonna, all will be revealed.
It's like when Perry Mason asked the Nygaard lady who was swimming in her really nice pool, he asked her about Sandhaven, and everyone watching probably thought, are we supposed to know about Sandhaven?
Yeah.
Is that from season one? And it wanted you to signal, or it wanted to signal to you that, hey, this is a key piece of information because of her reaction. She flipped a switch and said, I'm not going to talk about such as that. And you think, wait, was Brooks McCutcheon involved in something I missed?
Yeah, obviously, like you said, we know it's important from her reaction, even though it's just tossed off. But that was when I was watching it. I was like, where did he learn about this? Where did he get that name from? I could not remember.
It was from looking through the evidence at the end of episode one or sometime in episode two.
Oh, you're right.
And it was one of those pieces of evidence that was, or the only piece of evidence in the files that was put in by a gloved hand.
That's right.
So we don't know much other than that or why it's even being brought up. So it took me a while to kind of put that together.
And we know that we've already seen that Brooks has some unsavory dealings and some exotic tastes when it comes to amorous encounters. So it could be almost anything.
would you say hinted? Hinted might not even be strong enough of a word, that he was into some kinky stuff. Like, he had, it was, I guess it is hinted that he's choking one of his paramours there, his mistresses.
The waitress on the, or whatever she is on the boat, you know, when they first introduce her, she's coughing. Yeah. She's been, you know, he used a belt on her.
That's right, yeah.
And she's like, he's like, thanks for being a good sport.
Yeah, that's it. What a great way to encapsulate all that without being overt.
Mm-hmm.
One complaint I have about shows, all shows these days, is my Homer Simpson's dad yelling at the cloud moment.
Uh-huh.
They don't linger on text messages or writing. Because Perry finds some initials on the back of a picture in this episode, and I'm squinting my eyes and probably need my glasses nearby. But it's apparently there's a hospitalized young lady whose last name is Lawson.
Mm-hmm.
And it must be her brother's initials in the picture. She is catatonic. He's figured out she's somehow connected. This mm-hmm. is the Sandhaven plot. He's figured out she's somehow connected to Brooks McCutcheon's, maybe a former lover, maybe a former mistress of some sort, and she's now catatonic. And you got this. So that's my complaint. But it does produce a pretty good moment of creepiness where he takes her picture while she's just staring straight ahead.
She's just staring. That was kind of unsettling, I guess is the word to use.
So is she in such a mental state because he choked her too and some oxygen loss?
It seems like it's something that reflects badly on Brooks in some way, but I'm not willing to venture a guess quite yet, because although I do kind of think they're setting it up where they want us to think that this is a former mistress
mm-hmm.
that he's done something to.
Now, what her brother's initials have anything to do with all of that is yet to be determined. Holcomb, the detective from season one, the crooked detective, who's also really not doing much detective work in season two because he's got all his eggs in the basket of gambling ship. You load the ship, and when it goes offshore, you can gamble. He comes home, tells the lady of the house, you know, just doing paperwork at the detective office.
Staying up late. Does he even bother to show up?
At the
station anymore.
Does he have a job?
He seems like he's got a pretty full plate with the whatever that ship's name is.
Of course, that's going to come in and be.
Yeah.
It's one of those threads that's laid out. Right? You mentioned Paul Drake shooting the guns.
I did like Paul's kind of subplot this week because we got to see him do some of that fun kind of detective work that Perry was doing in the first season. It was kind of like. And he's done a little bit this season, but this was that kind of like sleuthing around.
Yeah, this is why you watch these sort of shows.
It's yeah.
Because Paul Drake shooting those guns into waterlogged telephone books that he's stolen from the street corners. So he's shooting them and as a substitute of what a bullet can do in a body or at least when it has impact on something. Did the brothers do it? Did they did rent a gun, apparently.
So they did. It seems like they rented a gun, and something is important about that bullet mark.
Well, it matches, I think, the evidence that Perry went and slew.
Right.
So they rented that particular gun. It leads Paul Drake back to the old Hooverville spot and tells the guy renting out guns, you did rent it to these two Mexican guys, and the answer is yes.
I am still inclined to think that the brothers are innocent, basically are being railroaded. The evidence against, you know, it's all circumstantial. It seems very flimsy.
They're being railroaded in a pretty high level way. If the gun's brought into play as well.
Yeah, they are.
Because Paul Drake, he paid to borrow. He rented out like all of the 38s or whatever that mm-hmm. he ended up getting, and it was just there was only the one that matched.
I did like, he's like, who rents guns?
Yeah, but
shooting a rat for supper, we're allowed.
The first encounter he has with gun rental is with kids.
Yes. I did kind of like, this just made me think about it, Perry's encounter with the judge too, about trying to get the brothers more out of like the general population, somewhere safer. I don't know. I like a lot of those scenes with Matthew Reese because he does a good job of getting, like, Perry's smart and determined, but also he's kind of like, you can't fight City Hall. So he's always sailing into the wind.
Too idealistic?
Yeah, maybe.
To the point, that's why he's disillusioned. He was too idealistic the first couple.
Absolutely.
Though I think that expecting someone not to go off and drown themselves isn't very idealistic, but he's still disappointed as how it all turned out, Case included.
Yeah. What do you think about the subplot with, oh, jeez, I always do this. I can't remember anyone's name. His partner and her...
Della.
Della, that's right. Della's new beau. Is it doing anything for you, or is it a distraction from the main heft of the plot?
Honestly, that's one of the times during the show where I am a little less interested.
Mm-hmm.
Because it hasn't turned into anything more that Della can do. Or, I mean, it's not even a will they, won't they.
It's, right. Because it's pretty clear they will. Yeah, they have.
Yeah. It's just an affair. The weird thing is that they haven't even shown Della's girlfriend from the first season much. Yeah, I think she might have been in the background of one scene. But that,
I think she was on the phone once.
Yeah.
And I don't think she's been, like, present.
So, you know, you start to wonder what's the point. But I do have confidence that will somehow cash out. But maybe not. Maybe it's just... We need to have Julia Rylance do more than just detective and lawyer work.
You're right. It might just be they're trying to, like, give her character another facet.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you, though. I think that it hasn't become weighty yet.
Yeah. I don't find it distracting. I just find it less interesting.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. We very well could bring back up Perry Mason.
I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, me too. I enjoyed that first season a lot. And this one seems at least as good. We may come back to it. Let's take a break and talk Mandalorian and Lucky Hank on the other side of this little bitty ad. Not only is there WWE and AEW, but the South is full of great indie wrestling. Who do you want analyzing what you've watched or covering what you missed? Superfan Corey Hanna and former indie wrestler Patrick Akers give you the news and the takeaways every Friday morning on Alabama Slam. Find it on the alabamatake.com or in any podcast app. Search Alabama Slam. Okay, let's spend some time on The Mandalorian, particularly from this week. It's an episode called Chapter 20, The Foundling. It's the fourth of season... Is this season three of The Mandalorian?
This is season three, yeah.
Yeah, it gets a little confusing if you've watched The Book of Boba Fett and you forget what's what.
Yeah, that was season 2.5.
Yeah, exactly.
I had a lot of fun with Josh Kay on the show, and I really enjoyed the moment where he found out that he was going to have to watch The Book of Boba Fett if he wants to have any idea what's going on.
Me too. Listeners, if you missed that, it's last week. We had Josh on the show, and he was very angry to find out he quit Boba Fett too early. The Foundling had Carl Weathers cooking Dragging up a stew. It. Yeah, he cooked up the stew, didn't he?
I thought that was great.
I did too. He's not in the episode, but he did direct it.
He's around.
Ahmaud Best played the saving Jedi for Grogu. He also played Jar Jar Binks.
Really?
You haven't seen that floating around online?
It's no. Like
it's everywhere now. Yeah. So the actor Ahmaud Best, he's the black actor who saves Grogu. He's a Jedi in this episode, but he played Jar Jar Binks. I think his name is Kelleran. He also had an appearance in an online game in the early aughts that was like a game show Jedi kind of weird thing. I never played it. He was the host, but
okay.
If Jon Favreau or Dave Filoni are listening, here's my advice: quit fucking around and bring back Jar Jar.
Everyone wants to know what happened.
Get some courage, blow the doors off the joint, and have that sumbitch come stumbling in a scene. He doesn't even have to say anything; just have it happen, and you will light the internet on fire.
Just have emotionless in the background. He's just standing there like a statue.
Yeah, this episode gave you two plots, basically, which was...
This episode maybe had a little too much and too little going on at the same time.
That's weirdly the case, right?
So yeah.
We had a foundling Mandalorian kid scooped up by some sort of pterodactyl-type creature, dinosaur-esque flying creature, assumedly to eat later, and they can't get him back in time without running out of fuel in their jetpacks. And then the B plot is the Grogu flashback scene where you find out, yeah, he was in the Temple of the Jedi's during Order 66, where, you know, they tried their best to kill all Jedi's. I don't think they got them all. They didn't get Grogu. Who else did they not get? They didn't get Grogu. They didn't get Kenobi. And they didn't apparently get the Rosario Dawson character who's coming.
What's her name? Ahsoka.
Uh-huh. Although, she's going to have her own show, so apparently she survived somehow.
Right.
All right, so...
And there's, you know, they've kind of hinted that others, you know, like in Kenobi, in Obi-Wan, in the first episode, the Inquisitors or whatever they are, are tracking down a Jedi who...
They're tracking down the last of them, right?
Yeah, so yeah.
That's their goal. Yeah, we'll let our guys at We Are Star Wars podcast handle some of this. I'm sure listeners are tired of me saying this, and now I think Natalie has joined the chorus when she's here, but this Grogu stuff has got to move at a faster clip. It's got to do a time jump. I don't care what you do. Just have him learn a few words, or maybe just get a half inch taller. Just the cutesy gaga part of him is hackneyed at this point. So when the focus is off of him, I think the show really soars, if you'll forgive the pun there. It's just bogged down by that. It's bogged down by two things. Here are my two problems.
Okay.
I'll let you respond.
No, Grogu, go ahead.
Grogu, it's too cutesy gaga. It's hard to act with someone who can't say anything but baby sounds. And the second thing is, I mentioned it last week briefly, it's the helmet thing. You know, everyone's in helmets.
Mm-hmm.
So those are two problems for me. Now, is the show good? Yeah, it's quite good. But you take those out, and I think it ups a level, whatever that level is.
I agree with you about the helmets, because, you know, there's a reason that, like, most superhero movies find a way to, like, either show you under the mask, or the mask gets destroyed, or something, because it's just everyone's, like, standing around with blank faces, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I did think that the show was a little nuts when it had, like, oh, Grogu's going to fight the other kid. It was like, what is going on here?
What part of it did you find so ridiculous?
Just everything. It's like, he's too, you know, they're like, he's small.
Yeah.
He puts him down, and he's like, you know, like a little lump of sack of potatoes or something.
He's a half foot.
Yeah, you know, he's just, Pedro, or what's his name, Jin Djarin.
Whoever's in the goddamn costume, I'm not even sure Pedro Pascal's in this show anymore.
You think it might be a James Earl Jones situation where he's at home, he's recording the voice, and that's it.
I mean, why not? But yeah, he sits him down, and he's starting his Mandalorian training.
He gets his first piece of Beskar.
And that's okay. That part's, like, that's the direction you want to go in. Start getting him grown. At some point, he's got to talk. Jesus fucking Christ. I'm just tired of this.
He's already 90 years old or something. It could be a while.
Yeah, that part is kind of interesting, because he looked to be even a little bit smaller in the Order 66 flashback.
I was thinking he hadn't changed much.
Yeah, he hasn't changed a ton. Same. Yeah. But there's this implication that saving him was imperative.
Yeah.
But the problem is, for me personally, is that the show hasn't shown me that other than a brief reference here or a flashback in this episode. You know, it's just sitting on a particular reveal, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think I would agree with you on that, because...
And they're wanting to milk it.
Yeah. I mean, the flashback scene was actually fine.
Yeah, it was okay.
It made this episode a little overstuffed, I think, but it was fine. But I agree with you that they wanted to have their cake and eat it too, where they're teasing this out.
You said it was overstuffed, but also empty.
Yeah, I felt like, I don't like the A plot where they're going after the dinosaur thing. Really, isn't that interesting? You know, it kind of serves to, like, I guess Bo-Katan gets in a little bit better with the whatever the group of Mandalorians, but I don't know. I'm already kind of tired of them just like hanging out in this Mandalorian base. Mm-hmm. Like I'm kind of like, can we go back to this? This is probably going to sound ridiculous, but I'm like, can we go more episodic? I did kind of like first and second season. You know, we had those great kind of like concept of the week. As ones, right? Like they do Seven Samurai for one, they do Wages of Fear for one, and they were fun. And they're just, I'm kind of tired of the Mandalorians. I think it's everyone standing around with their helmet on as part of it.
That's part of it. There's a way to do episodic storytelling and still be serialized in a way. Like that's what they did in the first season.
Yeah, I think they did a good job.
Yeah, it's interesting that my reading of critics is that they're obviously not saying this, but they tend to go all in episodic, all in serialized. But what about the blend, which I think is what The Mandalorian did well?
Every episode this season has been fine, like it has been, but I don't know, it doesn't feel like we were getting, like, for a while there, it felt like we were getting mini movies. It was just like, it's going to be a different concept every week. And, you know, they did some interesting things, like with the former Imperials and all that. It mostly seems like the Mandalorian is just going on a bunch of fetch quests. Like, he's got to go get the water. He's got to come back. Now he's got to find a bird.
Feels video game-esque. I think we've even mentioned that before about this show. It does, this episode kind of did a couple of things, and you mentioned as far as the A plot of, if you consider the A plot being Jaren and Bo-Katan, you know, there's them probably bonding a little, her getting more used to this sect of Mandalorian, which you've talked about. I think the third thing is to probably finalize Jaren's Pedro Pascal's character as a true member of their group now. Because it seemed as though, or we were supposed to understand that he and the bigger Mandalorian guy, whose son they rescued, had a little beef, or they were at least at arm's length from one another.
I think because in the second episode, maybe third episode, I think it was the second one. Isn't he the guy who's like, there's no way you really went to the waters? You know, like, he's got to be lying, you know? I think that was him. Because he's that kind of cool... I think it's kind of cool. He's got that kind of cool Gatling gun laser.
Yeah, it's huge. I don't know, folks. Is bringing home baby pterodactyls a good idea?
I was... That was another moment where it was like, what is going on in the writer's room? Like, has anyone thought through the implications of this? They got to feed them kids, first off.
Yeah, exactly.
What are they gonna do with these pterodactyls?
Exactly. Writing, as far as writing is concerned, as far as the show is concerned, it's apparently the Mandalorian creed to save foundlings. That's how Pedro Pascal's character became a Mandalorian.
Right. So. Although, I wonder, where on the sentience scale a foundling has to be.
I don't know.
How self-aware? Like, does it have to be a person? Apparently, it can just be a weird bird.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll leave some room for our guys at We Are a Star Wars podcast to dissect more of it. They're on a bit of a hiatus, but when they come back, I imagine they want to talk a lot of Mandalorian.
They're going to dive right into that Jar Jar connection.
Yeah, they'll get into that, all that, sure. They'll dive right into Jar Jar needs to come back. They won't do that.
The people have spoken.
This is the way. Let's talk about AMC and their debut of Lucky Hank. They debuted their new series with a regular of theirs, Bob Odenkirk. We all know him from Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul as Saul Goodman. I bet a lot of listeners recognize him from his days deep in comedy as part of the duo Mr. Show. Did you love Mr. Show?
Yes.
Yeah.
Some of the... I don't want to get totally off the rails here, but... he's so damn funny in so much of them. Like, there's one where he's the owner of, like, an adult bookstore. And his son's, like, wants to turn his back on pornography. And he's like, pornography built this family.
A line that might be used in this series. You never know.
It's great. He's so funny.
So Odenkirk and David Cross were Mr. Show. But anyway, his new series on AMC's Lucky Hank, based off the novel Straight Man by Richard Russo. Show premiered Sunday, March 19. Hank, obviously played by Odenkirk, I said that. He's a professor and department chair of English in this relatively small college. He's kind of burned out, maybe by the job, maybe by the fact that he's only published the one book, can't seem to write another. It's making his luster wear thin. We'll be discussing the first episode in depth, but no more. So just spoilers for the first. What did you think about the pilot?
I thought that, to sum it up, I enjoyed it. That's the short review. The longer review, I guess, is I didn't think it was doing anything particularly that we hadn't seen before. You know, like we've seen like, okay, kind of like middle-aged white guys struggling with disappointment. But Bob Odenkirk was so, like, there's just something about him that makes it like, yeah, okay, I want to see where this goes. I want to see this guy. He's funny.
That's really where I landed. I mean, 100%, everything I thought and even wrote for a couple of notes here. I was interested throughout, and I'm glad I watched it. I found it very entertaining.
Me too.
My disappointment and my nits that I'll pick stem from this expectation that I thought it would have more bite to it. Mm-hmm. I have not read the book. Have you read Straight Man by Russo?
I've read the book. Okay. It's been a while, so I don't remember it super well.
And that might be for the best.
I think so. Watching the show.
This show's probably just going to take a lot of the premises from that and run with it. I wanted Odenkirk to go off the leash and be much more scathing like he is in that first scene. And I think that maybe that was part of my expectation was I had a little coming in and then I saw this first scene where he chews out this kid, this student named Barto, who thinks his own writing's fantastic. And then most of the episode, it was kind of a little more of the same that you would get from Bob Odenkirk, which is great. It's fantastic, but it's still a little more of the same. I think I wanted it to either go in a blistering direction or swing into a more lachrymose direction or a melancholy direction, and it didn't really do either one of those.
It didn't.
That's not fair of me to say, here's what I wanted. It's, you know, we'd like to judge things by what they presented. And what they presented was what you're talking about, was a little bit more the same kind of thing we see. Middle-aged white guy, upset, burned out. But it's got time to be plenty of blistering as well as melancholy.
And I found it, you know, I found it enjoyable. I did think that having worked at a big university, the faculty politics were very funny.
Is that true to life?
I can't comment publicly.
Okay. Well, or was it more played up in the episode? Or is it similar? I don't know. I'm real curious.
You know, it depends. Honestly, like sometimes, I mean, they do play it up a little bit, but sometimes the faculty are just, especially the ones that are like aware of their own importance, can be a little much.
That happens in the high school arena, but not as much. Because we don't have published authors nearly as much. The idea that old Hank, Bob Odenkirk, Hank Devereaux Jr., is so bored by his job that he just makes the students talk the whole time is something I can get on board with. You know, that he notices and recognizes he's at a middling college as part of the prologue. I thought, now those things, these ideas are good. The execution of them as far as acting is good. It's somewhere in the middle. It's where it's not. I don't think I saw enough of him being like, this is a middling college and I can't stand these kids because they're middling or because I'm bored or both.
I did like how he was just getting increasingly flippant as the episode went on.
You know, I think that's something I needed to catch again. I might need to watch that episode at least a little of it again because I heard another person say he gets more flippant as the episode goes on. I don't know if I picked up on it. Maybe it was for me.
I think as it goes on, he just gets more and more. You know, the worse things get, the less seriously he's going to take them.
And that could be really fun.
I did like, I don't know why, but I thought the scene where Barto confronts him, he's like, "I've come to face you, like a man." There's something about like the way Bob Odenkirk's face looks as he's looking at this kid.
Yeah.
It was great. That was, you know, which is to say it did things that made me laugh.
It did, yeah.
And I found it to be an enjoyable experience.
For sure.
Watching it.
Quite enjoyable. Not quite the belly laughs for me personally, but I did, you know, a chuckle or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Even predictable things, right? Like him, you know, it's completely predictable, right? Like he gets vote of no confidence for the chair, and then the next day he's the chair again for 3 more years. And it's, you know, you probably could have seen it a mile away, but it was still fun. I laughed. It was still funny.
Okay, so that's the thing. You can see it a mile away, and on the screen it didn't create laughter for me because it was a little telegraphed, but in hindsight, it's very, very comical of a thing, especially if you place it in the reality we live in. If that kind of thing happens, it's hilarious because of the stupidity of mankind, really.
Yes.
James Poniewozik from the New York Times does say that this show differs from those usual white guy midlife crisis shows by focusing and staying in the mediocrity rather than pushing it out into a meth business or a mafia hit or I'm going to go join a gang.
Right. He's just stuck in it.
Yeah, so there might be promise even there. Did you think of White Noise at all from this episode?
A little bit.
I did too. They had a very similar campus feel.
They did. What is this thing in White Noise? It's Hitler studies, right? Like he's basically, yeah. And then here, that's a little bit more. Like White Noise, it's a little bit...
pointedly sarcastic is what I would say.
The comedy's a little broader too.
Yeah, yeah.
For the campus part. But yeah, they both kind of thinking about overlapping things maybe.
Yeah. Just the ridiculousness of academia at times, yes. I think, is where the overlap was. Did this pilot want to reckon with how annoyed we get with unfiltered honesty? Because that's what I took from it.
That's actually a good question.
We're annoyed with all. We like him, sort of, but we're pretty annoyed by Hank because his honesty is starting to get more and more unfiltered, like you talk about.
He's increasingly saying exactly what he thinks.
And there's this idea of I'm unfulfilled, and I think we all can relate to that, even if it is a white guy version of it again, once again. There's the shadow of his dad.
Yep.
The retired literary critic in New York, and you might know more having read the book. That's obviously going to play out. There's no way it doesn't. So you probably know a little bit more of what we should make of it than I.
He's got a little bit of a... sort of an Oedipus complex with his dad there. You know, he never live up to his father. Can't write the book. Can't get to the front page of the art section, you know? Like, he's totally stuck in his dad's shadow.
I will be keeping my eye out for how that plays. I really, again, not to have expectations and hopes, but I think that's a problem you have when you're only talking about the pilot or the first episode of something. Mm-hmm. But I hope that this is going to continue to critique a generation of college students that we haven't seen critiqued yet on film, not fully, and academia and how it is regarding any kind of change.
Yeah, and it's kind of critiquing the college kids and their parents, you know, where you know, like, we were so afraid of our kids feeling anything that the second they feel something, we rush in and try and save them.
Which his daughter will be an important symbol of some of that stuff. It can also mess around with men and women in the workplace. It could. So there's promise here, and Bob Odenkirk will keep you coming back even if there's an episode or two or three that falter compared to other television, I think. I think that's my case there.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. That's kind of like my longer review is... We've seen it before, but Bob Odenkirk makes it really fun.
And he's believable in the role.
He's great.
Yeah. I buy him as a burned-out professor.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to Kyle MacLachlan showing up.
That's another thing I was going to mention as we slowly
the president of the college.
Because he was teased in the trailer, and hey, it's 45 minutes every week. You're going to get Bob Odenkirk. You're going to get maybe the promise of Kyle MacLachlan in the next episode. I wish I honestly could see the second episode now. We run a couple of days behind the show's airing. So it's only an eight episodes first season.
Yeah.
And that, too, is, in a way, for me, promising, because it won't outstay its welcome. It's not going to be a 10 or 12 episode kind of thing where they want to, well, they'll be spread too thin on some plot lines. And again, I brought up some things that this show could explore, and it could definitely surprise us and explore even more.
I did enjoy the way, especially the poet, the woman who writes poetry, she's like, no one was brave enough to publish it.
What do you make of, is her name Gracie, the one who calls him as she's drinking wine by the fire?
Bobby, right? Isn't that Bobby?
Bobby. Okay, yeah. So what did you make of her?
She's also doesn't care.
No,
she's
kind of
like his, she's kind of a foil to him. I mean, a little bit.
A little bit, a mirror even.
Yeah, where you're getting that unfiltered honesty. You're getting the, I'm burnt out and I don't care. And then she's kind of able to... Well, not call him out exactly, but when she's like, don't write that letter for my daughter because I don't want her to live in this town.
Yeah.
You know, he's kind of like, and he seemingly can't leave. You know, that seems to be like a point of contention with him and his wife.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Episode one has him contemplating the idea of moving to New York. Always wanted to do it.
Can't pull the trigger.
He will not do it. What is it about the town that keeps him there, or that middling college, or it's imposter syndrome? You know, there's that too.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll burn you out as quick as anything.
Yeah, I agree.
If you made it this far in our conversation and was just wondering if you should watch it, if you ever feel burned out on anything, if you ever feel like you're, you know, swimming in one spot, this might be a really good show for you.
Yeah.
Seems like it would be. Well, we've reached the end of our podcast this week, but we're online. Find the show on Twitter and Instagram, both at Taking It Down Pod, one word. But our home site and production team are all at The Alabama Take on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We'll be back next week to talk maybe more Lucky Hank, maybe more Perry Mason. Not sure. Stay with us online, and we always send out notifications a couple of days early. See you then.